Well, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you again for tuning in to another episode of the Meaningful Connection podcast. Our guest today is fantastic. I'm super excited to chat with her. And today I have the privilege of having Dr. Joanne Meinecker on the show. And she's a sociologist, mother of three. What drew her, us to her is she has a really powerful TED talk called The Power of Meaningful Connection. Obviously, it's a perfect fit. She has a PhD from Queens, and she's also currently working in admin at McEwen University, but also has taught and researched there as well. So very, probably the most credentialed person I think so far on the podcast, I would suspect. So thanks so much for taking the time and appearing on the show, Joanne.
Thank you, David. Thanks for that wonderful introduction. I'm happy to be here. The name of your podcast, of course, really resonates with me.
Yeah. Okay. So if you could, before we get into the podcast or the TED Talk rather, if you could kind of tell us the backstory of how you got into sociology specifically, but just, you know, zooming in on meaningful connection.
Okay, great. Sociology took me. I went to university to study criminology. I had a very, very linear path that I expected to take because the career that I aspired to when I was little was to be a teacher. But as I got older, I started deciding that what I wanted to do was be a judge. So when I entered university, the path I started taking was to put myself in line to go to law school. But it was in my second year and then really in my third year of university when I took these classes like the sociology of law, women and crime. And it was, I think I talk about this in one of my TED Talks, it was somebody who really inspired me. And one of the things that just drew me into the discipline is that it's all about human connection. It's about relationships. It's about this uneasy tension between individual and society, between me and you, between things that are seemingly unconnected and disparate, but are really in context so enmeshed and so bound up with one another. So it's, I think you've spoken about how curious you are. Sociology is for the curious,
yep,
asking absolutely. Questions, trying to make meaning. And the areas that I zoomed in on were where people's lives were at the margins. Like, why is it that structures and systems tend to continue to perpetuate inequality? And so I wouldn't say I abandoned my path for law school, but instead I embarked on a new path to go to graduate school. And that's what I grew up in Winnipeg, and I went to the University of Manitoba, and then went to Ontario to embark on that next journey of getting my PhD.
So I was really curious about what you said about how there's the disparate things that are actually really intermeshed and such. What did you learn, I guess, so I'm assuming you went to a master's of sociology, right?
Yeah. And after my undergrad, I stayed at U of M to do that master's.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then you part of my journey that I missed. And of course I missed it because you were asking me about the academic side, was finding my life partner. And it was in my master's that I both figured out I wanted an academic job. Yeah. I had done some of those jobs at the front lines. I had worked at a women's shelter. I had done some volunteering in youth detention, and I'm super compassionate, passionate, and also like doing the research. And what I found was that front lines didn't play to my strengths. I got really emotionally wrapped up in it. And I could translate my skills and my passions more in the classroom and working with students to try and help them, you know, understand things better and make a difference. So the making a difference and making change has always been really important to me. But I knew in my early 20s that it wasn't going to be for me sitting across from the people who were dealing with the trauma. It was going to be taking a bit of a, I wouldn't say backseat, I'd say taking a different angle and a different positioning around how I could better approach and address the kinds of needs and the kinds of things that those populations, those people were going through. And one of the things that I've learned, that I keep learning again, sometimes lessons like you have to relearn, is there's things that all of us share, as well as so many ways we're different. It's like it's like that contradiction, and that it's both at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, yeah.
Like a lot of people, so I've noticed in certain administrative jobs, there's and frontline jobs, there's people that are exactly where they should be, and they're like shining in their little their light in their little spot. And then there's people that are like obviously not supposed to be there. It's insightful that you got there so early in life, because I've noticed, especially with social work and things like that, there's kind of two people that really should be there, and they love the job and they love what they do, and they can kind of pace themselves, because I assume it's a very emotionally draining experience to be that intensely used every day and that intensely utilized, I guess is a better word. And for some people, they go through that, they get burned out, and they just get super jaded, right? Whereas I think that it's smart to know, hey, like I can best serve other people by maybe taking an academic role or an administrative role or whatever the role is. There's, you know, you need people to be on the front lines, but you also need people passing the memo too, right? So it's good that when people figure out where their niche is, and it's really sad when someone's obviously out of the spot and yet still kind of keep trudging along for the paycheck or the pension. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's really true. One of the things that I've had to do in this role recently is an annual review, going up for a reappointment, things like that. So you sort of take stock, and it was a leap for me to leave the classroom, because now in my role I teach one class. Mm-hmm. In several classes and having a lot of students, and reflecting on what are the things that in my current role, when I deal with a lot of things related to other people's teaching and other people's research and groups of students that aren't in my own class but are dealing with different things that they've got going on, is I still play some sort of advocacy role. Like I'm thinking about what's in the interests of faculty members, what's in the interests of students, what's in the interests of the institution. And I think that's trying to find the commonality, trying to find the common ground so that there can be less conflict and distress, especially since all of us have been going through this collective trauma and collective emotional gymnastics, if you will, that has been associated with the pandemic. Mm-hmm.
So tell us, like, so you kind of went through your master's, found your partner, and then started realizing, okay, like, you know, you kind of, your life track kind of started. How did that kind of evolve into the meaningful connection talk and just the meaningful connection kind of emphasis in your academic career?
Yeah. One of the areas that I became really interested in knowing more about was youth crime and youth justice. And as I started teaching and looking at the main legal approaches, there's so much emphasis on the back end in reactive ways on how do we as a society, how do we as parents, how does the criminal justice system change and reform and do something so that the consequences are more effective, making them meaningful. Right, meaningful consequences after the fact for a young person.
But you, and, just specific, you're saying like someone commits a crime. What are we doing about it, right?
You know, how do I make you, David, give something in terms of after the fact and something that is going to be uncomfortable enough to, you know, make you learn your lesson? Well, that to some degree, you know, it's definitely popular. And the effective, I started to call into question the effectiveness of both being reactive and also focusing on the negative, the thing that was wrong. And what I was learning in my work with young people in Edmonton was the difference is not what punishment they get. The difference is the people that are able to make relationships with them that are authentic. The people that see them not as a criminal or somebody who has all this baggage, but instead somebody that has strengths and somebody that's resilient, somebody that just is a human being that might want to be heard. And then they do that, they listen. And so it was the meaningful connection in that term that when I landed on it in my teaching, I started thinking, well, this isn't just confined to any one group. This is really what I've been led to my whole life, which is about we're social beings. And when we don't have those strong social connections that do bring meaning to us, where we do feel like we matter and the relationship matters, we don't live our best lives. And so the timing of that was my second TEDx talk in 2016 when I did The Power of Meaningful Connections. The first one I did was called Just Care. And I really focused in that one on research that I had done and what led me to it. But in that second one, I took a different approach, and I was just going to treat it like a classroom and just go in like I was going to talk about why I thought this was really important and use that CARE, use that care idea to try to translate this in real practical terms. And then maybe it's a bit of insecurity. Maybe it was a bit of, is this what people expect? So a few days prior to, I started a script and I had verbatim everything I was going to say. And I've taught for years, David. I've been, as a person, I'm actually a little bit more introverted, but when it comes to the thing I know I'm good at and being in front of the classroom, I've done this. I've talked to large groups of people. And for whatever reason, when I walked out there, after the first line, the second line just didn't come. So my script wasn't there. Yeah.
Doesn't really come across in the video, but okay.
Well, if you listen really closely at the end, the jig's up. I kind of let people know this didn't go how I planned. And afterwards, I thought, did I need to do that? But I'm getting to my point. I promise you I'm getting to my point. So it didn't go as planned and it was fine. Obviously, you know, people saw it, resonated with some, but the big point of how you can learn something academically. I knew meaningful connections matter. I'm talking about meaningful connections. But then I go out and this thing I wanted to do, connect with the audience, get people inspired around how relationships are so important and human caring is the way that we can deal with our social issues and our own personal troubles. So here I have this moment that to me really was unsuccessful. I walked off and I wasn't crushed at all. I was just so grateful and happy that my husband was in the audience, that my best friend was there. And so it didn't go as I planned. The people who know Joanne, they still love me. I'm going to go home. We're going to have, it was a good thing. It could have been better in my eyes, but it's kind of so what? And I didn't really, really have that lesson where I knew it on a visceral level until that moment. So I wouldn't go back and have that scripted exactly because I don't think I would have had that feeling of being alone by myself afterwards, but I wasn't alone. Like I didn't feel alone. And I knew that I had people in my corner, which kind of gets us back to this whole piece about we all need it, this caring relational lives, we need it, but we don't need it the same way. And at different times in our lives, our needs are going to be a little different. And so at that point, I Yeah. Yeah. It was just a big kind of moment for me.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's almost like your friends and your family and those real connections that are really the important ones are kind of the balancing. So it's like they're the steady kind of state. And if something really crazy happens, you win the lottery, whatever, they're the ones that kind of pull you back down to size. And the same thing, they're the ones that pick you up out of those valleys in life as well. Yeah. Right. And I think that's why it's so important to emphasize connection over success, because we're really our fulfillment and satisfaction comes from, like you said, you did the best you could do, you walked off the stage, but really you had everything you already needed, regardless of the outcome of that particular speech. Is that a good way?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And I mean, it's not that the personal relationships in our lives are easy necessarily, but they're just so essential.
Mm-hmm.
And like the give and take and the trust building and the boundary setting and trying to show respect as well as, you know, want it back, whether it be from our spouses or from our children. It's, I think of that kind of caring as a practice. Sometimes you are going to get it wrong. And even if inadvertently you get it wrong, that showing up in those relationships is I think really what life's all about.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So,
and how do we be deliberate about creating those spaces? And I am now going to be saying things and reminding myself, because I know that this last year I haven't lived up to my own expectations around being a present mother.
Yeah.
When I was physically present more. Right? Yep. Because so much of that, my work life and home life was merged too much. What is that nice balance, right?
Yeah.
It was just too merged together.
That's a good point. So I want to make that point for myself as well. So to have standards and ideals to strive for is to be a hypocrite, because ultimately anyone who holds up an ideal will always inevitably fall short of that ideal. And that's just life. Like ultimately we have to forgive ourselves for where we fall short, forgive the people in our lives where they fall short, and accept that, like, you know, striving for excellence while not achieving excellence is still better than just quitting and giving up and just throwing in the towel and be like, God, I suck. So
I'd like to take a short sponsor break to tell you about the company I founded, Bunky Life. What we're famous for are small log cabin kits called Bunkies that can be easily built in a weekend without needing a permit or a second mortgage. I've also authored the book, Bunky Life, Extra Space. Ultimately, we're in the business of helping families create extra space for more meaningful connection. And you can find out more at bunkylife.com. To see if your family might be ready for the Bunky Life, take the free 5-minute quiz at bunkylife.com/quiz. That's bunkielife.com/quiz. And now back to the show.
So as you know, like, our audience is, people that generally have a good relationship with their friends and family, but they want to take it to great. And I think that you were kind of alluding to that. Like, so my job is to tease out, what are the most practical things that we can glean from your wisdom as a professional, that, you know, we can do with my family. Cause I'm learning as much as teaching I'm probably learning more than I'm teaching, actually. And I'm as like I was saying earlier, I'm as much of a hypocrite as anyone else is, but as together the community strives for, how do we build more connection? You know, what are the things that you've just most practically pulled out of the more esoteric research and just, you know, what you'd recommend, especially in light of, like you said, home life and work life have crashed together for a lot of people, to a lot of times our detriment. What are some just practical things that you gleaned in the last little bit from the research?
A big part is communication. I mean, you see this all the time, but I think thinking about, well, what does that mean and what does that look like? We can be talking, but maybe we're talking about things that don't matter, or maybe we're talking over each other. And so, again, it's relational. So being okay with saying, I'm not sure if I'm understanding you, David.
Yeah.
Right. Or I mean, this is connected to communication, but it's also a thing in and of itself. We are going to make mistakes and slip up, especially with the people we're closest to. So there's so much power in an apology and not a defensive one. It kind of moves away from being an apology when we start to justify why.
Well, I'm sorry I did that, but you did it.
Here's what was going on for me. My apology should be about you. Like, I've done something to hurt or harm, whether intentional or not. You're the one feeling that way. And I can think, I won't share them, but I can think of some times over the last year when I was the person that really should be recognizing what I had done. And when I held to, where I thought I was coming from, the connections, they can, something can get in between them. That's what I'm trying to say. Something can get in between them.
Yep.
And talking honestly and openly, that's the way to come back to each other. Apologizing, meaning it, that's another way. But time, time that we spend with people we love is, it's precious. And sometimes we don't treat it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's always a to-do list and there's always another email. And even there's always another show on Netflix, if you will.
Yep.
So again, that deliberateness, and going back to striving for perfection or to be excellent at it, being conscious and aware, I think, of these things is healthy. Fixating and trying to like do it all right all the time is not. And when I was listening to you talk in this lead into this question that you've asked me, I so was reminded of my own dad. And growing up, like, he would say, Joanne, strive for excellence, not perfection.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I internalized that a great deal as, those are the same thing, Dad. Like,
yeah, I could, you sound a lot like my wife, Carrie. Yeah.
So again, we're always learning, I think. And it's in relationships that I think we have so much that we can teach and learn, right? It's not just one way. Like, we can teach and learn. I've learned so much from my kids. I hope they've learned something from me. Yeah. But I really, really have.
Mm-hmm. I think that when you see kids kind of in their natural environment doing things, like you say, like, just one thing my 1-year-old daughter has no problem with is expressing what she wants, right? Expressing very clearly, as in the 20 some words she's got, what she wants and needs. And also, when they're sorry, they apologize. They do legit, apologize. I think that my oldest is starting to learn the non-apology, the BS non-apology from us a little bit. But yeah, when they're sorry, they really are sorry. And I think that another thing that kids really like to do is resolve things. So if they feel hurt or they feel angry or they feel wronged, they want to come full circle and get back to this, right? That's something that kids intuitively aim for and go for. Whereas adults, it's sometimes easier to go, oh, I'm sorry about that, Bob. That's okay, Jim. But you've just added just a little paper. You shoved a little wedge, a tiny little wedge in between the two of you, and that just grows over time, right? And I think that kids don't deal well with that. They just instinctively go for, I want full connection with my, especially with their parents. I guess another thought that I had was that you can just observe kids in their natural environment and think back to you as a kid and think, these kids are just little miniature versions of adults, or adults are just big versions of kids. And sometimes seeing each other that way, I found really helps me like empathize a little more with people if they're kind of going through a little bit of an emotional thing, just to be like, hey, adults are just big kids that have all those same emotional needs, but we put this veneer in between each other of adulthood. Yes. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. For sure. Yeah. The empathy piece I think is really important. And seeing what can be possible when we are creative with solutions, you know, and kids are a great example of that. And when you were talking about the coming back together, the restorative justice approach, and this is, I'm not an expert in restorative justice, and it isn't my background, but with that idea that when something has gone wrong, when there's been conflict, it's relational conflict. Like there's something in the relationship. So yeah, someone took something, or there's vandalism that's happened to this building, but what's really underlying that is relational breakdown. Mm. So the answer isn't just fixing the building. It right. isn't just getting the thing back. It's the people coming back together and resolving that wrong, that hurt. And I think children do intuitively have that when their environment cannot foster it. But if they're seeing that it's at that other level of right, you did this to me and I'm holding this against you versus a we, that what's going on for us here. So
So actually to the point of restorative justice, so is, you would know the stats way better than I, but isn't it true that like 80 to 90% of violence is within like people that know each other directly and are like usually pretty close contact with each other? And isn't like most of property damage and theft like from someone that works at your building? Or like I was talking, we were buying a factory for Bunky Life right now, and I was talking to the neighbors, like, yeah, 99% of your thefts are like your own employees or some disgruntled ex-employee that, like, it's not just like random burglaries and random violence happens, but it's the minority of the violence and burglaries and
yeah, like what I can say, we have to be really careful with crime statistics because it's so different. Yeah. But I will
directionally correct though with what I'm saying that, you know, most
for with property offenses, it's a little bit different.
Okay.
But with interpersonal violence, it's very common, especially for violence against women.
Yeah.
That the assailant, the person who's responsible for the harm, is somebody that is known to the person.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you've segued there to the work that I'm doing with a couple of my colleagues around sexual violence. Because what that's all about is spaces, and what kind of space do we have, spaces where people can be supported? And at institutional level, that project on Violence Interrupted is about sexual violence on post-secondary campuses, so like university students, but bringing it to other environments, like it can be schools, it can be homes, it can be communities. Are there spaces set up where people are able to be themselves, express who they are, make connections, right? Make meaningful ones that are authentic and give them value, and they can feel valued. And that project, I think, is a project for all of us, because that's where I think, even though we come from different places and have different backgrounds, it's in us to want to be with others and hopefully enrich people's experiences and be part of something bigger than ourselves.
So tell us about your work in that project. What's kind of going on specifically right now, and what are you guys kind of working on?
Well, the book itself came out, Confronting Sexual Violence on University Campuses, and I'm one of the co-editors. My other partners there are Amanda Nealon, who's at McEwen, and Diane Crocker, who's at St. Mary's. And it's an edited collection. So what we try to do here is look at all kinds of creative ways that people are working to deal with sexual violence on campus. And so that's that. And all of the proceeds go toward helping organizations for for those affected by sexual violence in Canada.
How, if someone wanted to get the book, how'd they get it?
You can find it. It is published by McGill Queen's University Press. But if you were to use a search engine to put in the title, which is Violence Interrupted, you can easily find out your local bookstore or ordering it directly from the publisher or other vendors. Yeah, it's out there.
Yep. Cool. I guess, so to kind of reel it back to the whole family thing as well. So, the family members that that are maybe on the fringe, because that's kind of your backstory, right? If you have a family member on the fringe, what are some of the most practical ways you can kind of reel them back into the hopefully, you know, you've got a family member you see is maybe going in the wrong direction, whether that's, you know, your immediate family or maybe like more of an extended family situation. What are some practical things that you found can be done?
Anything that can show them that you care and that you are there. I think that's probably the most practical thing. Now, that doesn't look the same way for everybody. So it could be a text, it could be a telephone call, it could be, you know, just reaching out in some way, right? Yeah, I don't know how helpful that answer is. I think are you looking for something more tangible?
Well, the more tangible we can get, obviously, but I think that's pretty tangible. Like, you know, text the guy, right? Like, sometimes it doesn't need to be this super elaborate thing. Sometimes it can just be like, go and have coffee with the person that, you know, is struggling. And just so they know that they got someone in their corner. I think that can be the difference between, you know, like someone like yourself that, you had a tough situation, but at the end of the day, I still have my husband, I still have my kids. Like, and I feel the same way too. Sometimes we'll just get destroyed in some aspect of life that feels like the end of the world. And I'm like, ah, oh, you know what? Still have the same roof over my head and the same, you know, four girls to kiss at night, and it's okay, you know? And, that perspective really comes a long way. And if for someone that's maybe on the fringe, maybe they don't have a lot of those connections. If you're the cousin that does, or you're the uncle that does, or you're the brother that does, it might make all the difference.
Yeah, I mean, people want to be seen. People want to be seen and heard, I think. And just thinking of my own recent experience, my mom passed away in December of 2019. My mom, I could do a whole podcast on how phenomenal my mom was, David, but she was just this incredible woman who defied all odds and was always a very private person. So I'm careful not to say it too much. And it was not sudden, but sudden. It was not unexpected. My mom's health had deteriorated, but it did happen quicker than we expected. So it brought us together as a family, even though my father and my brother and his family live in another province. Relying on each other, talking and sharing memories and moments about my mom with my family members just made all the difference in the world for how I was able to go back to my family and not just be a mourning daughter, but be a wife and be a mother and be an academic administrator and try and be a friend in my circle. And because I could be really vulnerable and express the pain of that loss. And it wasn't limited to like right after my mom's death. We were able, this was prior to COVID, and we were able to have this wonderful celebration of her life. So there was that. And then you go back into your everyday life and moments happen where you're so reminded, and having people that are able to help. I think we're helpers and we need help. Like it's again, this kind of piece of of duality that is, I think, our answer to a lot of things that we can, again, in relationships that are enriching on both sides, that can flow where love and support and respect and sometimes just venting can go both ways. That's what I found really, really helpful in my own personal life and in watching my students and in my day job.
Mm-hmm. So I guess tell us what you're working on right now and kind of what the future, do you have any more books you're co-authoring or working with, or the next little bit, any more TED Talks in the queue that we should?
I don't know. You know what? It's funny with the TED Talks because I talk about my middle son who in the one that we're referring to, I talk about my middle son. And in the first one I did, I talk about my youngest, my daughter. And so I've said to my oldest, who's now 18, if I'm on TED, no X, it's going to be all about you, Aiden. But I don't have anything like that planned right now. I am thinking about a project that's looking at leadership and care and trying to understand the ways that leaders, and I'm not sure yet if it's going to focus just on academic leaders or leaders in various places, business owners, community, and not-for-profit. I don't know because it's just at the very beginning stages. But how do they practice caring in that management leadership role? How does care figure into policy, into the ways that they relate to employees? Because it's something that I've found has been really, really helpful in allowing me to move from one academic role, more as teacher and researcher, into administration, is recognizing that care is going to be something that I want to see from people, but I have to model that real caring, not just lip service, but you treat people as human beings first. And yes, they're in a role and they have responsibilities, but that is a focus. And so I don't know what I would find. It'll be a qualitative study. I tend to do much more qualitative research, doing interviews and focus groups and trying to hear stories of where care appears, where it goes wrong, where it goes right, and what we can learn from that.
Mm-hmm. Makes a lot of sense. Well, I think that everyone should check out the TEDx talk for sure. So it's hilarious that it was just improvised on the spot, but I did not expect that at all. It's a fantastic talk. If you type in the power of meaningful connection, or probably even I don't know if meaningful connection would drop, but it's on YouTube. We'll probably have the link in the show notes as well. I would encourage everyone to check it out. And it's. Do you have a personal website or any other social media platforms you want everyone to check out, or is it would be the TED Talks?
I'm on Twitter at Joanne Meineker.
Okay.
And I do have a private Instagram that's called Bold Care Life. And one departure from my academics was the year I went on sabbatical, and I started a bit of a project that didn't turn into a full-on business called Cared Humanity, which is this whole notion of how do you put care with humanity, and the tagline became Be Bold with Care. And so Bold Care Life and that kind of notion, I'm on Instagram at Bold Care Life.
Cool. All right, awesome. Well, check it out, guys. Joanne, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for your taking the time today. And like I said, everyone check out the TEDx talk. It'll definitely make you think about things in a new way, I would say, but they're the same old things that we always talk about, which is ultimately satisfaction and fulfillment are found in just meaningfully connecting with people that matter most. So thank you so much for taking the time, and I look forward to speaking again.
Thanks, David. It was definitely my pleasure. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you've learned a lot, but beyond just mere intellectual entertainment, I hope it's changed the way you see relationships and inspired you to take action and make a connection with someone in your life today. Do it. I'd love to hear about it. And you can always email me directly at david@funkylife.com with the subject Meaningful Connection. Love to hear your stories.